is going to come up later on, straighten out everything I say. But evidently there was one announcement that needed to be made. February 20th is the next Coffee Like This, but there is to be a tour of the castle and a talk on December 12th at 9:30 in the morning, and the speaker will be Mrs. Marina Downing, the wife of the Vice President, Deputy President of the Navigators. And anyone who would like to come to that on December 12th at 9:30 in the morning is very, very welcome. I was given that word of announcement. How'd I do, dear? Okay. Heaven help the home. She said, I've either got the wrong recipe or I've got the wrong ingredients. I've put my whole life into this stew, and if this family isn't the worst mess of goulash I've ever seen, it just makes me want to give up. That's a quote from Howard Hendricks' book, Heaven Help the Home. And it is on the bookstall. It's the only thing I use from the book, but I wanted this opportunity to give it a little push since the topic was taken from his book. Well, what about this distraught person? What's her problem? How would you advise her? Is it her recipe? You think it's her ingredients? Or would you tell her just give up and really, it's not worth the effort? Ruth and I have a little agreement. Whenever she bakes an apple pie, I eat it and rave. My end of the bargain is the easiest and the most pleasant. Last month, she baked an apple pie. She's baked some since. But that one is memorable because it looked like all the other pies she'd baked, but the crust was soggy. And in effect, because it just wasn't up to her normal standard, it was ruined. What happened? Well, she had the right ingredients, but she just hadn't put enough of some of them, flour especially. The ingredients were in the wrong amount. Something was missing. What are the ingredients in a marriage? Well, there's one woman, one man. The right ingredients are there, but I think many people feel that something has been left out. I wonder if you've had that kind of an experience with cooking. You know intuitively how to make a pie, how to bake cookies, your favorite cake, and you go ahead, you throw the ingredients together, you don't bother checking the recipe, and every once in a while it flops. I'm not too familiar with cooking, except the eating side, but that same sort of thing happens to most men that I know when they buy a piece of equipment. I'm familiar with it in terms of buying a car. We just bought a used Toyota to help us get around town. My son especially, who's 16 now and is involved in activities, all the family unity that we've been building up over the last 16 years just about goes out the window every time he has to get somewhere and Ruth has to get somewhere and I have to get somewhere. We've had the privilege of spending the last 15 years overseas. And so we're just getting back used to being Americans again. And that was a little bit of a hard adjustment to need two cars, because in the places we've lived, one car is not a necessity, but is a luxury. And so I resisted that, but we finally invested about 2 months ago in a used Toyota. Well, now I've driven a lot of cars, so I got in the car and started it up, and it went fine. Then when the weather got a little bit colder, I got in the car, pumped the accelerator, held it to the floorboard, started it, because that's the way we start our other cars. And the starter ground, and it ground, and it ground, and it wouldn't start, and finally, Now, this didn't actually happen, but it's happened in many other areas of my experience. And finally, the starter doesn't work, the battery's dead. You know what you do then? Then you read the manufacturer's handbook. You've heard that saying, when all else fails, read the directions. Well, that's embarrassing, and it's really quite ridiculous. Now, if I would have done that, it might have cost me, what, $10 for the wrecker to come and start the car, or it might have cost me $20, $25 to replace a battery. If it had been something more serious, it could have cost the $1,400 we had to pay for the car. But how valuable is a home? You can't place a price on it. And yet how many of us go intuitively into a marriage, into a family, without checking the manufacturer's handbook? And that's what I want us to do this morning, just briefly. I'm going to give the first couple of points, and then Ruth is going to give the third point. We want to talk about what the manufacturer's handbook has to say about the family, and about marriage, and about the home. My first point is this: heaven has helped the home. Heaven has already helped the home. Past tense. God has given us some operating rules for this institution that He made. Who then best to give us the operation instructions? Who best to give us the recipe than the Creator? Genesis 2:24 is one of the first ingredients. Right at the beginning of this relationship, God said, "A man shall leave his father and mother, and he shall cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh." I just love to go into detail in this, but maybe you can do a little bit of thinking and reflecting and Bible study on it at some other time. But God said, this is what's important: to leave home, to cleave to your mate, and you therefore become one flesh. That's right at the beginning. Another ingredient in the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 5 says this: "Wife, submit, be subject, adapt to your husband in everything." Is that one of the ingredients? He made it, not me. Ephesians 5, 25 to 27. "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. Husband, love your wife as you love your own body. Nourish her, cherish her." Ephesians 6, "Children, respect and obey your parents." Ephesians 6, 4, "Parents, don't nag your children, but train them and teach them the way of God. Don't discourage them by too much correction." Well, now those briefly are the ingredients that the New Testament and the Old Testament talk about making up marriage in the home. And you know what my experience is? That those ingredients make the tastiest stew that you can imagine. Because the one who created the whole institution knew what was best for us. Just take the ingredient of parents training and teaching their children. My son is 16. Up till now, we have a very good relationship. And as I look back, I think one of the very important things was the fact that when Mark was young, and even now that he's a little older, we made some rules, and we enforced them. Now, we don't make as many rules now as we did when he was younger, but the fact that when he was younger, we had certain rules, and if those rules were broken, and if they were broken consistently, he was punished. And we found that in his early years, that instead of harming him, instead of driving a wedge between us, every time we corrected him and spanked him, Mark's affection for us, the one who did the punishing, grew. So these ingredients are really meant for our good. He became more affectionate, and it kept us together. Now these ingredients, these rules, these operational instructions that the Creator has given us do two things. First of all, they tell me that God loves me. Do you realize that? That God gives us laws and rules, not because He wants to make us miserable, but because He loves us and He wants to do us good. In 1 John, we read this: "God's commandments are not burdensome." And that was a real breakthrough for me as a young person, to realize that God was not an ogre trying to make me unhappy, but He was a loving Heavenly Father trying to do me good, if only I would walk in agreement with Him. His commands are not burdensome. The rules of God, His operational instructions, are for our good. Then the second thing it teaches me when I read these laws, as it probably struck you, I need help. When I see God's standards for my marriage, my first reaction is help. That's beyond me. I just cannot keep up to that. And these rules reveal my tendency to selfishness. Just take that one. Husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church. I'm supposed to love Ruth like Jesus Christ loved. What did Jesus Christ do? He was the perfect Son of God, without flaw, and yet He became sin and died a criminal's death voluntarily. Why? Just to satisfy some whim of His own nature? No. For me. He gave of Himself willingly for Ed Rice and for every person here and every person in the world. Donald was a young man in London, an Oxford graduate, about 6'4", probably weighed 200 pounds, every bit of man. He'd become a Christian through his girlfriend, Jean, and then eventually married her. And Donald told the story how he learned this lesson. He said, coming home from work, he was in the custom of putting in his mind the things that he wanted Jean to do for him as soon as he walked in the door. And he began to realize that this is not what Jesus said or what the New Testament teaches, how he should love his wife. That rather, instead, he said, I must begin to think about how I am going to do things for Jean as soon as I walk in the door. And I think that's what the New Testament says a husband's love for his wife is supposed to be. That he thinks not in terms of what is she going to do for me, but now as soon as I walk in the door, I wonder if there's something I can do to ask about how her day has gone, to see if there's something I can do to help her with the children. And you say, well now, I mean, if I were talking to men now, you know what they'd say? Impossible. I've got too many needs. And you, of course, sit there and say, well, I wish my husband could hear this. But let me tell you that you also, as a wife, have the privilege of loving your husband the same way. Let's look at 1 John 3. This epistle John wrote to Christians to really remind them that love was the hallmark of every person who took upon himself the name Christian. Love. And so he says that this love is to not just be a mark of the husband's love for his wife, but it's supposed to be the mark of every believer in Jesus Christ for every other believer. And you know that includes Ruth. And that includes her love for me. And it includes my love for every other person. And just look at how John defines this love. In 1 John chapter 3, or rather, don't look, just listen. In the first part of this little paragraph, he says, don't hate like Cain did and killed his brother. But love one another. And we think, well, I'm okay. I don't hate my wife. I don't hate my husband, so I'm okay. But John doesn't let us get away with that. Love is more than just the absence of hate. And he goes on and defines it. He says in verse 16, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Isn't it interesting? He uses the example of Jesus laying down his life for us and says that's exactly how you are to love your husband. That's exactly how I'm to love my wife. Lay down my life for her. Now I think that we think, well, yes, if the house started to burn, I'd go and rescue my husband. It's not talking about that kind of a laying down of your life, that one great sacrificial effort. But it's talking about that day by day by day laying down your life. We had this happen. Mark, as I said, is 16. And we've learned that when children are that age, they don't communicate and talk to you as much as they did when they were 7, 8, and 9. But when they were 7, 8, and 9, they didn't say anything that was very interesting anyway. And so now that they're 16, they're talking about drugs, they're talking about sex, they're talking about things that really are interesting, and boy, you want to listen. And if you've listened when they talked about nonsense, then they're going to talk to you also when they're talking about important things. But Mark doesn't go to bed as early as we do now. He comes in probably 12 on the weekends. And this one night he came in and he had a lot to talk about. And we'd gotten to bed late a couple of nights and we were both exhausted. But, you know, we got up and listened to him. And he talked to us for an hour. That, in a sense, is kind of what I'm trying to say, is laying down your life. It's daily, every day, taking the time to listen to one another. Laying aside what you've got planned and thinking in terms of what that other person needs more than you think about what you need. And this is not something that happens just once, but daily. Look at verse 17, because he doesn't stop there. He says, if anyone has this world's goods and he sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? You have resources. Your mate has needs. And he's done something that you feel takes advantage of you. And you hold yourself back. You're like this. How does the love of God match that? It doesn't. If you see a person has needs and you have the resources to meet those needs, you have the privilege of doing that and not holding back. Verse 18, he doesn't let us stop there, but he goes and defines it even more. He says, little children, let us not love in word or speech, but in deed and in truth. You say to your husband every day as he goes out and every night when he comes home, I love you. John said, that's nice, but that's not love. Love indeed. What do you do for your children? What do you do for your husband? And what do I do for my wife? What do I do for my children? It's deeds that mark love. And if you're waiting for a warm feeling to come over you before you do this, I don't think you find that in 1 John, as John teaches us what love really is. It's willing, giving acts for that other person. Well, you say, wow, Ed, you're kind of coming on strong here. I feel a bit guilty. Good. Now, I don't think it's my aim to make people feel guilty for the sake of guilt. That doesn't do any good. Unless it makes you hungry enough to want food. You've got to be thirsty before you go take a drink of water. You've got to realize you're lost before you seek help and find the right way. So if guilt leads to the solution, then I would say good. If it doesn't, please forgive me. But just to summarize, these laws that God has given us show us that He loves us, and they show us also our selfishness and how far short we are of God's standard. And this leads us to the second part. Heaven has helped the home by giving us these rules, this recipe. But heaven also helps the home, present tense. You see, God has not left us just to stew in our own guilt. He's not stopped there. Here is my low performance in my marriage relationship. And I'm conscious of how far short I am of this standard over here that God has set. And there's this huge gulf between my performance and God's standard. Do you know what bridges that gulf between my performance and God's standard? It's the cross of Jesus Christ. That's the bridge. And I'm sure there are some there sitting here today, and you say, you Christians are all alike. Always talking about sin, always harping you know, always, you know, can't go any, always make me feel guilty. Here you go again. Actually, you say, my home life is perfectly satisfactory. Thank you very much. And I'm really glad for that. But I wonder if sometimes we're not like the little boy who comes in from playing all day Saturday, and it's Saturday night bath time, and he very sincerely comes into his mother and he says, I don't need a bath. What's his problem? He's not looking at himself with his mother's eyes, but he's seeing himself just with his own eyes. And Billy next door has been playing with him all day Saturday, and he stands next to Billy and he says, I don't look, you know, I'm no dirtier than Billy. We don't need a bath. When he compares himself with another kid, of course he doesn't. But when he stands against his mother's clean sheets that she's just put on the bed or the clean towels in the bathroom, he knows, or at least she knows, that he needs a bath. And I wonder if we're not like that. Do you really see yourself not comparing your relationships with your neighbor or even your parents or other people, but this standard that God has set? Do you see your need? I do. Every time I read this, I see how far short I come. But every time I see a cross, some of you ladies have got them on chains around your neck. Men wear them in their lapels, little bitty crosses. Every time I go through a town and I see a church on a steeple, do you know what I think? There's Jesus dying on the cross with my performance over here and God's standard here, and he's bringing them up to par. Now that's why they call the gospel good news. And that's when I first heard it, I thought this is just like a cold drink to a thirsty man. Because I realized how far short I had come of God's standard. Whenever you see that cross, and you're conscious of your low performance and God's high standard, you know what you can say? That cross makes the difference. It did make the difference. I want to just close my little part by holding up a gem and letting it reflect its various facets. There's a gem in the New Testament that I think if you would just reflect on, you would just see how beautiful it is. It's in the letter of 1 Peter, chapter 3, verse 18. And I want you just to see it glisten and glitter. 1 Peter, chapter 3, verse 18. It says this, "For Christ died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but resurrected in the spirit." Just think about that for a moment. Christ died for sin once for all. It's not something that he has to do over and over and over again. That one act of his death on the cross canceled this gulf between me and God once for all. That's good news. Then it says this, "The just for the unjust." Here was the perfect, holy, righteous Son of God. And he did that for Ed Rice, who is so far down on this standard, you can't even see what his performance is. "The just for the unjust." He didn't say, "Now clean your life up, get things straightened out, put everything right, and then I'll die for you." The just Jesus Christ died for the unjust Ed Rice. That's beautiful. And that catches my attention. Then he says this, "that he might bring us to God." And I like that. I just see, here's Ed over here, way down, so far down you can't even register what his performance is. And here's God's standard, and here's Christ on the cross, "that he might bring us to God." And then he says this, "he died in the flesh, and he rose again in the spirit." Do you know the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a fact? It's one of the best attested historical facts. It actually happened. And that resurrection is very important for you to consider. Lots of men died on crosses. Lots of good men died on crosses. Lots of good men died unjustly at Roman hands. Jesus wasn't the only one. Why does his death make any difference? Because of who he was. And God brought him from the grave after 3 days to show who he was. This is one of the most important facts in history. Everything else pales into insignificance to me because of the truth of this. Well, now Ruth is going to come and just share a little bit on how heaven will help the home. But I want to close just by saying this as she comes. I realize I'm talking to women, and your husbands aren't here. And you say, well, if only both of us could come into this kind of a relationship with God together. Well, unfortunately in life, things don't always turn out the way you want them. And do you know what the New Testament teaches? It only takes one person in a marriage, right with God, first of all, and then loving selflessly and giving to make a difference. It only takes one person in a marriage. So I'm talking to the right people. And if I were talking to men, I'd say the same thing, because they blame their wives, just like we tend to blame the other person. It only takes one person. Ruth?
Being the subjective member of the family and quite a practical person, I'm just going to underline what Ed said just from a woman's point of view, really. When we talk about heaven helping in the home, and he has said that it was really God, we're talking about how he intervened in history and has come to help the home and is helping it. And I'm just going to bring it back a little bit more practical to you and me as women. Well, I find as a wife and a mother, as I get older, the older I get, the more I realize how much help I really do need. I have discovered that I'm a very selfish individual, and I don't like to think that, but I've discovered that I am, and especially since I've become a wife, and then when I became a mother, and you know it starts early in life when your nights are interrupted or there's something you're just dying to go to, and your child gets ill, and all of a sudden you realize that you are quite a selfish person. And this is what I'm referring to. Well, I know how selfish I am since I've come into a relationship with God. So I think, well, what in the world would I have been like without him? So I just thought I would mention a couple of ways that I feel God has practically helped me as a wife and a mother. And in one way, it's through the instruction that I read in the Bible. There's a terrific verse in Deuteronomy, chapter 6, verses 6 and 7. And it says that we are to take the words that he's commanded us and teach them to our children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. Now, in other words, all during the day, be alert to situations. And in our lives, in our family, we don't have a time when you sit down and say, well, now we're going to just discuss the Bible, or what has there been anything in your mind lately about the Bible, or to make it just a one-time thing. We've tried to make it a lifestyle, and it started off, really, in just small ways. And some of you have heard me mention how when we were in London, and Mark and I went to a pet shop, and we looked at these tiny fish in an aquarium. And I couldn't help but say, my, look at this, you know, these teeny fish, and they're all alike. They've all got the same stripes. So I was just remarking about this to Mark. You know, well, Mark, how can people say that there is no God, or that someone hasn't created these things? Then there was a certain flower as we walked to the bus stop. He and I just loved this particular plant, and we'd remark about that. And I would just, you know, it'd end up that God was the one behind it. Well, then about a week ago, he and I were just sitting in the living room talking about where he's going to go to college. And there are a couple of possibilities, you know, and so I said, well, we'll just have to pray about it and see where God is going to lead you. But, you know, what I mean is, it just came as a matter of course. It was in just really a casual conversation that just happened. It wasn't even planned. Well, James 1:5 says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and he'll give it to you. And I think this is what it means, because every day we just need wisdom, just in reactions or actions to the kids. When we first came back from England, you know, it started with dress, because with Paula, and Mark. Paula went to a girls' school, had a very proper English uniform. Mark went to a boys' school, had a very proper English uniform. And we come here and they end up wearing overalls to school. You couldn't believe it. You know, you would have, you thought, well, if I had said, now, when we get to the States, they do things a little bit differently. And you remember seeing people on farms, you know, and sometimes they have... They probably would have said, oh, how awful, but, you know, of course, that's what I'm getting at. I had to learn to watch my reactions and my actions. Well, I feel God helps in things like this. As a mother, well, what about as a wife? Well, Ed's brought up this a bit. Having a Christian husband, however, does not guarantee that you go through life smiling and, you know, being patient. And, you know, people look at you and say, my, isn't she? Isn't she a patient person? And Ruth Graham once said, if both of you agree on everything, one of you is unnecessary. And I think that's terrific. However, the rub does come, of course, when you do have a disagreement. And I long ago was reminded of a verse in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3, and it says, and this is in the Bible too, women, but I would have you know that the head of every woman is the man. The head of the man is Christ. The head of Christ is God. And one wife pointed out to me, if you have a disagreement with your husband, and he really feels strongly that this is what God thinks that we should do as a family, then you are to submit to that decision. All right, now let's say we've already talked about it. I don't mean that he says, well, Ruth, come on, we're going to do this and that and the other. We discuss it, and maybe I might have more light on one subject than he does, so we talk it over together. But he makes the final decision, and I, by scriptural standards, am to abide by that, even if I disagree. But, you know, if he makes a mistake, I go scot-free on that one because he's answerable to God. However, he is not wanting to make mistakes, and he's not wanting to do the wrong thing, get out of God's will. So, you see, you really gain in the long run. Well, that's another way that helps me. What about the times when Ed misunderstands me? I'm trying to communicate, and he misunderstands, or he doesn't try to understand. What about the times when there's something that I want to share, but it's almost too personal to share with a husband? Now, you may think, perhaps there are some of you that think there's never any time like that. But I've discovered that there are. Maybe there are times when I can't even talk to another person and explain how I feel. Well, then I find that this is where God comes in again. And if you've never read it, when you go home and have some free time, read Psalm 139. It is absolutely marvelous for the times that you and I get to the place where we just get overwhelmed and we wonder, well, what is going on? And we turn to Psalm 139, and it's God who is saying he knows us. He knows when we sit down, when we rise up. He knows when we were in our mother's womb. In other words, he knew me before I was born. He has all my days written out, the days that were formed for me when there weren't any. Now, in other words, that's bringing in the sovereignty of God. That means he knows all about me until the day I die. Plus the fact that his thoughts to me are very precious. And if I could count them, they are more than the sand. And a person like that I can go to about everything because he's the one that formed me and created me, so he knows me. So we're back to the manufacturer and the manufacturer's handbook again. Well, God wants each of us to be thrown on him. In other words, Ed, there are times when he can't completely come to me and pour out his heart and say, I know Ruth is going to give me the comfort and understanding that I need because I can't. I'm just another human being. And it's unfair of him to expect me to be God, and it's unfair of me to expect him to be God. But that's the beauty of it, because as he goes to God and as I do, we're brought closer together as we are brought closer to God. And that to me is absolutely marvelous. Well, I wanted to just read a quote from a book by a man called Keith Miller. He's had several books, but this is called Habitation of Dragons. And he says this, I believe this restless yearning for completeness in relationships is universal. And although we try to fulfill it through friends, mates, and children, it seems to me that this restlessness can never truly be satisfied by people. I am becoming convinced that this deepest unrest is a longing for complete union with God, which is planted in the fabric of every man's life. Maybe Augustine was right when he said that our hearts will be restless until we find our ultimate rest in Him. That's what I'm getting at. I think that this is the picture of us individually getting our relationship with God correct. And then it affects every other relationship in life, because life is a series of relationships. Don't you sometimes get tired of just relating? You see, I'm tired of people. I just don't want to relate to anybody. You know, not only my family, but the people around me, you just get tired of, you know, relating. Well, I think that this is what he's getting at, that it's only God who gives us the resource to be able to have the kind of love that Ed was trying to talk about, which is a God love that does not seek to get. You know, how many people do we gravitate to because of what they give to us? Our friends, you know, you stop and think of the friends you have, or the people you gravitate to in a crowd, even if you know them all, you gravitate to the ones that you feel the most comfortable with because they accept you. Well, this is what it's really getting at. But, you know, I've got to bring it down one more personal point, and that is, what if you don't have a personal relationship like the kind we've been talking about? Because it's possible this is new to you. Well, there's another terrific verse in Revelation 3, and it's also a picture of a home, but it's my heart. And the verse says, "Behold," and this is Christ, "I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will fellowship or sup with him and he with me." And a lot of you have seen the picture of Hunt's picture of Christ knocking at the door. And the door is all grown up with weeds around it, and there's no handle on the outside. And of course, it's a picture of our lives overgrown with things that we know are wrong, maybe just wrong attitudes. I mean, I'm sure none of you have committed murder, or, you know, we categorize sins, don't we? But we know that there are attitudes or there are things in our lives we're not really pleased about. And that's the picture. The vines and all of the weeds represent that. And then there's no handle on the door. Well, why not? Well, because Christ is never going to force himself into our lives. And that is really lovely. Because I have to do the opening from the inside. And this is what I challenge you today. Perhaps you've never done it. You've never asked Christ to come in and be personally involved in your life. And that's what I would like to just challenge you with. Because we've been talking about the home. But it has to start with our personal home. My relationship with Ed is better because we both have a relationship with God. But when I stand before God, it's going to be by myself. I finally realized it wasn't going to be with my dad, who was a Baptist minister. I couldn't get in on his coattail. It had to be something I had to decide for myself. And I would just challenge you to consider that verse. And I would think that God could be knocking at the door of your life today and saying, "Well, I want to come in." And even if you don't have any unhappy home, we're not insinuating that we all have unhappy homes, but they are made better, really, because of this relationship with God. We are not experts and don't have lots of answers, you know, but if there is something that you had a question about and we could show you from the Bible, we'd be pleased to do it. Ed, especially, would be available afterward. I'll offer his services. But there might be something that's triggered a question in your mind, and so just feel free. And one other thing, if any of you are interested in Bible study, there are several of us who are already involved in this. There are some women here this morning, and we've had an absolutely marvelous relationship getting to know one another and getting to know more about the Bible every week. And perhaps you, at this time in your life, are interested in something like that. And if so, there is going to be a study started in January. And if you would, Jerry, where are the sign-up? You're going to pass them around. Okay, and that's going to be passed. And if you felt that you would like to be involved in just finding out more about what we've been talking about and or questions that you've had about the Bible, please feel free to do so. Jerry, there's no more announcement then?
No,
we have nothing more.
They can go from here to tour outside.
If you would like to stay a few minutes, if you are interested in signing up for a group, I'll put one of these on each table, and you can just feel free to sign the other one as you can.
Okay, thank you very much.